We're going to look at a new paragraph this evening in Romans chapter 7. We kind of wound up the previous paragraph by combining several verses together and jumping over some of the issues that are there. And of course, we'll come back to a few of those as we have need to refer to them. But in our studies of this paragraph from verses 7 to 12, which we just wound up, we were introduced to Paul's first question in terms of our response to the things he said in verses 7 through 6. And that question was, is the law sinful? And he raised that issue because he said in verse 5 that when we were in the flesh, sinful passions were through the law. So that makes a kind of a connection to the question. Well, then, does that make the law sinful? And his answer, of course, was absolutely negative in terms of the overt initial response. And he concluded that paragraph with a conclusion, verse 12, that the law is holy, and the commandment part of the law, which is the imperative mood, the actual demands of don't do this and do that, the commandment is holy and righteous and good. So that paragraph raising the question of whether this law itself is sinful was answered negatively, absolutely, with a strong negative. But in his dealings with the issues that are involved in the answer to that question, he raised another question. And that is, he said in verse 9 that he was alive once apart from the law, but when the commandment came, sin was resurrected and he died. And the commandment, which was initially for life, proved to be for death in his case because sin received an opportunity through the presence of a commandment and killed him. And so one of the issues then that is raised next is the next question starting in the paragraph, starts in verse 13 and actually goes through the rest of the chapter. It's a long paragraph. But the question in verse 13 is, did therefore that which is for good become for death for me? They translate it, become a cause of death for me. And the reason why that question comes up is pretty apparent because in the previous paragraph, Paul declared that the holy law in the form of a holy, righteous, and good demand or commandment became an instrument in the hands of the sin to kill Paul. And that almost automatically raises this question. If the good commandment was useful to the sin as an instrument of death to Paul, does that mean that that which is good became death to Paul? He says, did that which is good become unto death for me? And his negative answer almost sounds like he's contradicting himself because he said, the commandment came and sin was resurrected and I died and the commandment which was for life proved to be for death for me. And therefore, he says, did that which is good become a cause of death for me? So you can see where the question's coming from. But one of the things that we automatically do, those of us who have respect for the scriptures as an inspired revelation, therefore we assume on the basis of inspiration and the law of non-contradiction that Paul wasn't denying what he had already said. He wasn't contradicting himself like some of the skeptics will say. So that means then that we have to understand what he is actually saying. And that's part of the reason why last week I tried to point out the fact that he uses the reference to law in a couple of different ways, because on the one hand, he denies that there's anything sinful about law as a principle. He says that the law is holy and the commandment aspect is holy, righteous, and good. But he also uses the term law in relation to verse 11's frank admission that it was through a deception that death was the result. And my argument last week was, if you take law and then twist it so that it's a deception, then you're not talking about law anymore, even if you use the word. And that's kind of the way Paul used it in the paragraph verses 7 through 12. So this evening what we're going to do is try to understand We can understand why he would raise the question, verse 13, because he almost, it does sound like he's contradicting himself in verse 10 when he says the commandment was to life, but it proved to be to death for me, and therefore did that which is good become for death for me. And his negative answer sounds, like I said, sounds contradictory. So because it's not, we need to understand what he's really driving at. So the first thing I want us to think about is the essence of the question itself in terms of the parts of it. One of the first elements of the part is his description, therefore, did that which is good become unto death for me? So there are two issues here. One's good and the other's death. And so we want to think about this issue of good, because it was in verse 12 that he said that the law and the commandment is holy and righteous and good. So what does he mean by good? And that's not a hard answer to get to, simply because verse 10 is in the text. According to verse 10, the commandment was, it's translated to result in life, but in the Greek it's was unto life. And what it's doing is using the preposition unto to point to the intention. We call that the telos, the end, the objective. So that the telos, or the objective for the commandment, Paul says in verse 10, was life. And we can put a capital L in there, since we explained last time that Paul in this text is not talking about physical life. He's talking about the life that can only be called life because it's an experience of the life that is of God. So the requirements for experiencing the life of God are forgiveness, redemption, the gift of the Spirit, the presence of yourself beside God, having responded to the parakalesis, come over and stand by me so that the life that is mine will envelop you since you're beside me. That's the idea of life, and life as a quality of experience, we've said over and over and over and over and over, has many aspects, but the essence of it is joy. And even the concept of joy has to be understood better probably than any of us do, but nonetheless, he is saying that the intended telos of the commandment was life. That's verse 10. And life as a qualitative concept is the result of an unrestricted harmony that exists between the God of life and the recipient of his laws. Because he is the living God, and the laws that he gives are intended to spread that life into the experience of those who are recipients of his law. That's the statement. God gave the commandment to make life possible for us. But part of the mechanisms of all that is what verses 7 through 12 is all about. That the function of law was to reveal, not to regulate. And the revelation of sin by law is a part of the process of coming to life, not because there's a direct relationship. I mean, you don't come to life because you've been exposed as a sinner. That's only the first step. You come to life when you accept the revelation that the law gives. You see yourself as a sinner, and you turn from any kind of a earn merit type of response where you can redeem yourself by undoing something that you did, or you can do something else that will kind of compensate for that. The law never intended that to be the response. All of the sacrificial aspect of the Old Testament Mosaic law was designed to teach you that you couldn't, that something had to die in order for sin to be forgiven. And in the Old Testament setup, all of the animal sacrifices were ineffectual for actually getting rid of the sin, but they were not ineffectual in teaching this truth, that sin requires death of an innocent sacrifice in the place of the person who has done the sinning. And of course, that was all foreshadowing the whole idea of Jesus being the one who would become the sacrificial lamb in our place. So it's kind of a zigzaggedy trail to how law produces life. But that was God's intention. And we have it very clearly in verse 7 that the intention was for law to reveal truth that would enable then a person to seek a response to that truth that would actually enable him to live. And that's where the gospel comes into play. If you are revealed to be a sinner, there's no hope for you for life unless there's a promise from the life giver that you can have that sin handled adequately, legitimately, and then you can be put in the presence of the life giver and then his life will flow over to you. That's the whole issue. So when he says that the intended telos of the commandment was life, we know that that's the definition of what it means to be good. The law is good. The commandment is good because its intention is life. And that means then that we need to see goodness in terms of the divine intention rather than the methodology. The methodology can be a twisted track. It can be an issue where you have to think very carefully through so that it becomes a fine line or a slippery slope or whatever. There are all kinds of little details in the mix. That's why there is so much revelation so that we can see by that revelation what these details are, and that's why we're summoned to pay attention to the words of God and that kind of thing. And Jesus even said that life was supposed to come out of giving attention to every word which comes out of the mouth of God, which means that life is kind of a complex issue. But nonetheless, it's not the methodology that's in view in verse 13. Did that which is unto good become unto death for me? The intention was good. The methodology is not in question. And the problem is, and I think this is the reason we have to distinguish between intention and methodology, the problem is human ignorance. It is a foregone conclusion that created human intelligence, or even created angelic intelligence, will always be a finite reality, and therefore it will always have huge gaps of understanding. There are things about infinity that finitude will never get. And because it will never get it, there is just this problem of ignorance. And that's not a necessary problem. I mean, the infinite God can say to a finite human being certain words that, understood and believed, will enable that person who receives them, understands them, and believes them the capacity to live. In spite of vast complications of ignorance, on one basis, in terms of human ignorance, the statement in verse 13 that was repeated from verse 7, may it never be, may genoita, the King James says, God forbid. But that's just the strongest way of denial that you can express in Greek. Well, there isn't anybody that has any problem, well, any thinking, relatively mature person, that has any problem with, no! What's hard about that? It's just no. And there's no ignorance issue with absolutely not. But there are any number of human beings who have ignorance problems with the details of the reasoning behind that unambiguous no. Technically, when infinite wisdom attempts to explain anything to finite reason, there can be problems. Some of those problems can be handled by this most basic denial. Absolutely not. God forbid. Emphatic no. If the human finite creature or the angelic finite creature has been in the mix long enough to have developed the kind of value for God that it ought to have as a creature, if the love of the angel or the human has reached the point that in the existence of the finite creature, there is this willingness to simply love the God who created. There will be a firewall of protection against deception, because love will step in the gap and say, you don't need to know all the reasons why. All you need to know is I said no. And that's the thing that parents often have to fall back on when their kids in their inquisitive years say, but why? Because they can but why you to death. It doesn't matter what you say. The next thing out of their mouth will be, but why? And they just keep pushing you until you finally say, because I said so. That's why. And kids often are not satisfied with that. But very often a child in that age bracket, if the parent and the child have a halfway decent relationship, the child will back off from that because the parent has said, we're not going to deal with this any further. I said this, and this is the way it is. If the child loves the parent enough to accept that, there's no more problem. And in the same way, when God, as an infinite being, says something to a human being, especially a human being who has been redeemed by the cross, has become a child of God, has experienced to some degree the love of the Father, has been given the Spirit that coming into him cries out, Abba, to the Father. If that created, redeemed person has enough experience and time to develop a certain basic level of love for the Father who redeemed him, then absolutely not enough of an answer. God said, no, that's good enough for me. That's what the typical issue is. The love for God that is almost automatic to the child of God, because we love him because he first loved us, there's kind of an automatic reciprocity that gets in there, especially early. When you're first saved, you really don't have a problem with loving God back. And that becomes then a firewall against deception, because deception will come in with all these subtle arguments. And you'll see something very clear in the Word of God, and you'll say, well, that God said it, and I believe it, and that's enough. In fact, we've heard that a lot of times. God said it, I believe it, that's good enough. Well, yeah, if you love God enough to accept that. But the problem with human depravity, even for redeemed, saved people, is that the depravity issues of, quote, the sin, unquote, don't just evaporate. There's a problem here. It's the human depravity within the shell of the creature, the finite creature. And even though initially love may overwhelm that, at some point, the questions that depravity will keep egging on and the issues of, I don't know how many of you may have read C.S. Lewis's trilogy that had to do with Paralandra and that hideous strength. And have you read those books? Yeah. Well, in one of them, the gist of the thesis of the book, the story was that Ransom, the guy, had been shot off in a rocket and he had landed on this virgin planet. And he met a man and a woman there who were, that planet's Adam and Eve. They were sinless. And then Ransom's ancient nemesis came into the atmosphere. He apparently had gotten in a rocket ship and gone to the same place. But his goal was to corrupt the man and the woman that were there. And it was Ransom's job to try to stop that from happening. And in C.S. Lewis's story, Ransom tried to be the buffer to give the woman who was being tempted by the adversary some intellectual reinforcement or ammunition against the arguments that he was using. And Ransom finally came to the conclusion that this isn't going to work. He is going to keep on and keep on and keep on without let up until she breaks. And there is nothing. I cannot keep giving her answers that will stop this process, because he's never going to quit as long as she's willing to listen to what he has to say. So he decided the only solution was to kill him. So Ransom and this nemesis had a battle, and that's where Ransom got the wound in the heel and he killed the... But anyway, the general issue there was that there's always going to be, because sin was present in the creation before Adam and Eve were in the garden, because the angelic rebellion had already happened, sin was already there, the adversary of God was already committed to being the anti-God, and he wanted to destroy the plans of God, and so he was committed to trying to undercut whatever God did in his creation. And as long as that's there, there's always going to be this nibbling away at the love that says, God said it, I believe it, that's enough. That's enough if you love him enough. But if you can be persuaded that he does not love you like you think he does, then your love for him will be diminished in proportion to that. And that's exactly what Genesis 3 tells us that happened. The first rattle out of the cage, the serpent challenged the love that God had for Adam and Eve by telling them two things, that he was a liar and that he was a manipulator and he didn't want them to know some things that would really be good for them to know. And that subtle, cynical insertion made the God forbid or absolute no longer enough. And so in verses 13 and following in Romans chapter 7, we have a sufficient answer if we love God enough, just because he says that which was good did not become a cause for death for me, period. It was not the law's fault that I died. It wasn't God's intention for the law that I should die because of its presence. That's enough, if you love God enough. But who of us does? So because there is this constant nibbling and pushing and the cynicism just being constantly reinforced and, see there, I told you, see there, and using the circumstances and so forth to try to undercut the believer's basic love for his Father, because of that, there has to be some more information. And that's what verses 13 through the end of the chapter are, some more information. So, in terms of the goodness, if Adam and Eve, if Paul, in Romans chapter 7, verse 9, if Paul, as well as Adam and Eve in Genesis 3, had believed in the goodness of God sufficiently, an absolute no would be enough. Because he says, the nature of goodness is to produce life. Life is the objective here. The law was given for life's sake. And then the second issue in the essence of the question is, did it become unto death for me? And that raises the issue of the nature of death. And Paul actually presents the death issue in verse 13, as well as in verse 11, as an accomplished telos. It was an objective pursued and achieved. And he's asking if it was the law that had that objective and achieved it. And his answer is no, it was not the law. Because the issue of goodness is life. And the issue of death is an issue that cannot be connected to goodness. And if the law was good, then death cannot be involved in the intention of law. So there has to be another explanation. And the rest of verse 13 is the rest of that explanation. But nonetheless, the death issue for Paul and for Adam and Eve in the garden was an accomplished objective. Satan was able to accomplish this objective. The nature of this death telos, this end, this objective called death, is most fundamentally a separation between the giver of life and his intended recipients, so that there is a wedge driven between his life and their experience, and that in the scriptures is the opposite of holiness. The fundamental metaphor of holiness in scripture, I think, is light, so darkness becomes a part of the problem. So there's a wedge driven between God as the God of life and the recipient of life as the person who is supposed to believe the telic intent of law as good. The person who receives law as a deceived person, suddenly there's this wedge of darkness driven between the two, and that cuts out the issue, many of the issues of life. There's no sharing of life now because this darkness is in there. And so darkness is allowed a place, and that makes the flow of life significantly hindered. And the only solution that is given in the scriptures for that is the magnitude of Calvary. It's only through the death of the Son of God that the union can be restored between the living God and the person who has had a wedge of darkness driven between him and God. So that's the essence of the question. Is the law, which was intended to be good, did it end up as a death issue in my case? And the short answer is no. But as we've already oversaid it enough times, I suppose, the short answer is a slippery slope of fine lines. And the short answer is only helpful in setting up a firm barrier, an adamant, unambiguous denial against drawing the wrong conclusion. So if absolutely not the answer, then we need to understand what the rest of the answer is, because now we have a barrier that says, okay, God didn't want to kill me when he gave me the law. When he allowed law to come into the place, his goal was not to kill me. And it's amazing how many people think that it is. There are just too many rules. God doesn't want me to have any fun. They mean fun. They mean life by fun, but nonetheless, the whole mindset is God is my enemy. He is out to kill me. He is out to ruin my life. He doesn't want anything really beneficial for me. He's just looking for somebody he can manipulate and use and then throw away later. That's the accusation. So we get this short answer, absolutely not. But then he turns right around and starts giving us some of the details. So we want to look at this longer answer. He says at the middle of verse 13, rather, it was the sin. This is the capital T, capital S. The sin. I think that's a theologically significant concept, the sin, because it involves not only the actual act of disbelief by Adam in the garden, but it also involves the spirit of that disbelief, which Ephesians 2 turns into a personal being, the prince of the power of the air, the spirit that works in the sons of the disobedience. And it also involves the automatic outcome of that sin causing this barrier between God and Adam and Eve, which they reflected as soon as they heard his voice and ran and hid. There was a wedge of darkness between them now. So he says it was the sin that caused the death, in order that it might be shown to be sin by bringing to pass my death through that which is good, that through the commandment sin might become utterly sinful. In other words, it wasn't the commandment that brought death. It was the instigator of the sin that brought the death. Did he use the law? Yes, he did. But he didn't use the law lawfully. He used the law deceitfully. That's what verse 11 says. The sin took or received an opportunity by having an imperative in place. God saying, don't eat of the fruit of that tree, or in Paul's case, don't lust. Took the opportunity given by the presence of an imperative, and by deception, twisted that into a way to kill the person. And remember, death is a separation. Killing a person doesn't mean that their body stops functioning. It means that their relationship with God is now interrupted. The life of the living God cannot flow unhindered to the person who no longer trusts him. The deceiver has created an image of God in the mind of the person who's been given the imperative that causes God then to be seen by that recipient as underhanded and manipulative or whatever, and that makes him not trust. It's automatic. You can't trust somebody you see as an enemy. You can't trust somebody that you don't see as good. So it wasn't the commandment that brought the death. It was the instigator, and the reason that this process was actually initiated by God, the God, in Genesis 3 and also in Paul's case in verse 9, The reason that God initiated that is because sin was already a present reality in the creation. The creation had already fallen in the angelic realms. And so the creation of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden on the earth, though their setting was pure and holy and undefiled, it wasn't going to stay that way because the serpent, the ancient adversary, the devil, was going to come into that pristine setting to bring about the corruption, if he could. And so God, in a very real sense, put up the first barrier. Don't do that. That's the imperative. That's the commandment that is intended for good. And so God said, okay, if they understand love for me as the creature's responsibility to the Creator, this negative, this demand, don't eat that, will be enough. There's no problem with understanding. Did you mean don't bite off the skin? Did you mean, you know, don't peel it and just eat the skin? What are the no details, just don't eat it. There's nothing problematical about that. But the adversary was described in Genesis as more subtle. And the subtlety is in the area of deception. And the issue of deception is clear in verse 13. According to the end of the verse, the issue that Satan is trying to get across is that sin is no big deal. Sin is no big deal. You don't have to worry about not being in harmony with the Creator that created you. You don't have to worry about that. It's not a big deal. Because people who think that sin's not a big deal don't get very concerned about being in harmony with the God who says at Calvary, sin is a humongous big deal. You think I would have sent my son to die? To suffer what he ended up having to suffer, and it was no small thing, if sin wasn't a big deal. It's a big deal. But people need to see it as a big deal. And so Paul says in verse 13 that the sin was allowed to use something that was actually designed for good to bring about death by that very thing so that sin could be seen for what it really is. Paul says that the sin was the author of the telos called death. It was sin in order that it might be shown to be sin by affecting death through what is good. The telos of death was a consequence of sin, the deception, the disbelief, the spirit of the disbelief. So he says that sin's the author. And then he says that this author needs to be exposed for what he really is. And then he explained the unveiling. The sin used as an instrument a very good commandment to produce death. The imperative is given. The imperative is for life. And the sin takes it, just twists it enough to create a problem and then applies it improperly, and the person who is listening is deceived by that and dies. In other words, verse 11, when it says sin, receiving opportunity through the commandment, deceived me, it says in verse 13, it was sin by affecting my death. That word translated affecting is a word that means it worked really hard. It was real hard work. And what it means is that there was some real hard work going on to get both Adam and Eve and Paul, after he'd been saved, to go back on the truth and be deceived into an unbelieving position in their minds and hearts. Extremely subtle deceit, very diligently worked at by the sin. And the essence of that deceit is the core to this whole thing. And that's what verses 7 through 12 were all about. The essence of the deceit was that the commandment was a prohibition against the experience of life That's the deceitful liar's interpretation of a prohibition given to Adam and Eve, given to Paul. Thou shalt not lust, thou shalt not eat. These are only prohibitions designed to keep you from experiencing something that's really good for you. God's a manipulator. He's trying to keep you from being able to enter into real life. And so he's cutting you off from something that would be good for you. That's the subtlety of the deceit. The subtlety rests upon a most basic lie that almost everybody, including Adam and Eve in the garden, are completely blind to. The basic lie that most people buy without even thought. And that basic lie is this. The claim that the quality of life, in my experience, is dependent upon more than the God of life. That's a lie. But almost nobody believes that's a lie. Almost everybody believes that you got to have God and your good health, or God and a lot of answers to your prayers that go your way, or God and some other people who believe like you do, or God and the whole issue of God and is a deceptive lie. The God of life has no problem sharing his life directly with anybody who's willing to trust him and believe him. And that's the bottom line, and it's provable in human history by multiple examples of people who have had everything but God taken away from them, and they still exude the presence of the life, the joy of life. It's not a widely seen thing, because it's not a widely believed thing. The deception is rampant. Everybody thinks you can't just have God in life. You've got to have God in some other things. And those other things can be God-related, like answers to prayer, but you don't have to have the answers that you want for God to do for you in order to have his life, unless you think that they're required for your life. And if he doesn't do it the way you ask him to, then you can get mad at him, and then you've just proven that you don't believe that he's the author of your life, but your own agenda is. So, the subtlety rested on this most basic lie that almost everybody has bought into, and the lie exists in spite of multiple proofs that it's a lie. I suppose the best proof that it is a lie, that you have to have God plus something else in order to have life, is all the people who have God plus something else and don't have any joy. The proof is there. If it's God plus all this other stuff, and God plus all this other stuff does not equal joy, then obviously it's a lie. You don't have to have God plus. In fact, your lack of joy may be because you have a God plus. Israel had God, and then they had all the pluses of the land flowing with milk and honey. Houses they didn't have to build. Vineyards they didn't have to plant. Harvests that they could do without having to plant the plants to start with. More food than they could eat. They had God plus all this stuff. And what'd they do with it? Proof is in the reality. But that's the reason why the sin, according to verse 13, had to make this extraordinary effort, effecting extraordinary effort, my death. This extreme effort was necessary in the first place in Genesis 3, because the God who gave the commandment, don't eat of that fruit, was the God who had placed them in this garden and showered them with everything they could possibly need for life. They had more food than they could eat, more water than they could drink. They had fellowship with God every day in the cool of the evening. They had everything that they could possibly want, need, whatever. There was no need for lusting because no needs were going unmet in any sense. So God had a track record with Adam and Eve in the garden. God had a track record with Saul of Tarsus once he brought him out of his legalism and brought him into the life of the gospel. He had a track record, short, at least initially, but he had a track record. And that means that in order to get a person to go back on that, there has to be a lot of energy expended. And Paul says the sin did that. It worked really hard to take the commandment and twist it into a way to kill me. And what was that twist? Well, I think the extreme effort took the form of using the threat of the loss of an already given benefit in the Genesis 3 case. Paul says that Eve was deceived, but Adam was not. So why did Adam eat it? If he wasn't deceived, why did he take a bite? I think that the reason he did is because Eve had already eaten, and he knew what God said. You eat that, you're dead. Well, what's that leave me with? The dead wife. So here, the very blessing of God, the only thing that was not good in the garden was for Adam to be alone. So God created this special solution to that not good thing. And now, that not good thing has become not good again because she's eaten and she's going to die and I'm going to be left here by myself and I'm not willing for that to happen. So I'm going to eat too. I think that's what was going on. It was taking the blessing of God and latching onto it as if life consisted of God plus my wife. Or God plus all the fruit of those other trees. Or God plus all the water of those other... This God plus thing. And in Paul's case, I think the threat existed by reason of the blessing, the joy that had come to him post-Damascus road, post-conversion. He had this joy blessing, but then because he wasn't a child, he was a grown adult legalist converted, he had this baggage thing where he had already received throughout his legalistic heritage a number of things that brought him great pleasure, joy. So, in coming to God and coming to life, he still had these agendas of joy, and God will always challenge idolatry. Sooner or later, his children will always face the things that they think they have to cling to have the life. If the thing they're clinging to is not God himself, God will always challenge that idolatry. Because he will always challenge it, there is always this threat that comes to life. You're going to lose your joy if you buy into that. And so they say, I'm not going to buy into that. Well, don't you know your life is, the joy of your life is wrapped up in God? No, it's not. It's wrapped up in God if he gives me what I want to keep, or lets me keep what I want to keep. The point here is that sin is very easily seductive by subtle deceits. Unless, verse 13, the end of the verse, actually comes into play. By realizing that the deceit involves the whole issue of how we see law and its intention from God, unless we see sin using the good to kill me, we will never see sin as utterly sinful. And that's huge. Because without sin being utterly sinful, then there's no high value on redemption or forgiveness. It's not a big deal. And without the values on redemption and forgiveness, people simply do not and cannot get along with each other, including God. And without the ability to get along with others, the blame game gets into high gear. And guess who gets the initial blame? God. If God hadn't have made that rule, I couldn't have broken it. I couldn't have died. That's the beginning of the blame. And, of course, we saw that blame game start as soon as Adam and Eve were confronted in the garden, and it's never finished. I believe that Paul is saying in verse 13, the law did not become a cause of death for me. It was the sin using the commandment that did it, and it was the purpose was so that God could show us just how deceitfully wicked the sin is. The prince of the power of the air, the spirit that works in the sons of the disobedience, is a master at subtle deceit. And until he and his deceptions are seen as utterly sinful, then we will probably not respond properly to the God of life, because He is constantly summoning us to His side, and we don't see the summons as necessary because I got a good life. Why do I need to get right over here beside you? I'm happy. I'll be glad just to go to heaven when I die, if that's the best there is for me. And so people just walk in their shadows of darkness thinking they're not missing anything. And the reason is because to them, sin's no big deal. Sin's a huge big deal. And that's why Paul says God used the commandment. He put the commandment in there, and then He allows Satan's deceptions to play out in order to make sure that those who are redeemed by Him begin to appreciate the sinfulness of the sin. Becomes utterly sinful. And then there's a lot of other verses that explain even more some of the stuff, but that's enough for this evening.